over all my excess wheat beyond immediate needs to a commissariat who will distribute it according to desert. Those doing hard manual labour will get the most, while those who do work that is not physical will scarcely get any. That means the likes of you will go hungry," he told Henderson, glancing sideways at Dmitri. "It sounds completely unworkable," Henderson sympathized. He introduced Dmitri, and they talked for some time about the new economic system the Bolsheviks planned to impose countrywide, with strict quotas for everyday commodity. Dmitri had not heard all the details of the new plans, and was horrified at how quickly the social structure of the country he loved was being ripped to shreds. Part of him accepted that the aristocracy, of which he had been a part, had no place in the 20th century. For a privileged family to own the land and all its products by chance of birth, and for those not so lucky in their parentage to have to work long hours on said land and pay taxes to boot, was a recipe for rebellion. But the alternative the Bolsheviks proposed seemed childishly simplistic. If land were owned communally, how would they make everyone do the same amount of work? Who would make the investment necessary to rebuild and renovate facilities, as his father had done on their estate? The farmer's face was reddened by the elements, but his eyes were a clear blue and his hair a short silver-grey thatch. "If I could afford it, I would move south to Crimea, which the Bolsheviks have been unable to take," he said. "My wife's family come from there, and it's good farming land. The extra hours of sunlight mean they get two harvests a year rather than our one. In Yekaterinburg, we farmers are lucky to break even. I don't know how I'm supposed to find excess to give the state." Dmitri bided his time until there was a lull in the conversation, then ventured, "I hear your daughter works in the Ipatiev house. Does she tell you anything about the mood of the imperial family? I imagine they must be very fearful." The farmer shook his head. "Shocking, isn't it? If the Bolsheviks have evidence the Tsar and Tsarina were traitors, let them produce it and try them in a court. If not, why can't they be released to live in exile? Yelena, my daughter, says they're a charming family who are grateful for every little service. She feels sorry for them."
"Is Yelena here today?"
Dmitri asked, looking around.
"She's over tending to the pigs."
He waved an arm in the direction of a shed some 100 yards away. They continued talking, but Dmitri kept an eye on the barn until a girl walked out carrying a bucket. He was too far off to tell much about her appearance, but she looked tall and slender. She walked in their direction, and as she got closer, Dmitri saw that she had shoulder-length brown hair. Suddenly, a plan began to take shape in his head. Was it crazy? Could it possibly work? While Henderson and the farmer continued their discussion, he tried to think it through. "How much money would you need to relocate to Crimea?" he asked the farmer abruptly, interrupting their conversation. Tolmachov was puzzled.
"Why do you ask?"
"Name a figure," Dmitri insisted, and the farmer thought for a moment, then came up with the sum of 2,000 rubles. Dmitri continued, "If I give you 2,000 rubles, would you consider asking your daughter to help us communicate with the Romanovs? We are trying to get them overseas, and we need someone who has access to the house." The farmer was instantly suspicious.
"Who are you? How do I know you're not a Bolshevik spy?"
"I can vouch for him," Henderson said quietly, and Dmitri gave him a quick nod of thanks.
"Well, I suppose I would consider it. What do you want her to do? Carry letters back and forth?"
"Not exactly," Dmitri replied. "First of all, I need you to find out the days on which she will be working over the coming weeks. Can you do that for me?"
2,000, you say?
In cash. In cash.
It sounds as though we could work together, my friend."
The farmer shook Dmitri's hand, and Dmitri could see the gleam of hope in his eyes, hope of a way out of an increasingly difficult life. This might work. It must work. Dmitri rode back into town to see Thomas Preston. "I need to talk to one of your merchants about the safest route out of Russia. Are any based in Yekaterinburg?" Preston's eyes widened.
"You have a plan?"
"I'm working on it."
"The best man would be Henry Armistead. Let me give him a call."
He lifted a telephone receiver and instructed the secretary on the other end to get Armistead on the line, then hung up and continued.
Between ourselves, he was part of a plan to rescue the family from Tobolsk. They were going to travel down the river Yenisei to the north coast, then sail round to Murmansk on a Norwegian Arctic shipping line. The scheme had to be cancelled when they were moved to Yekaterinburg, but perhaps he could arrange something similar here if you can get them out of the house.
Dmitri spoke urgently.
Please ask him to come as soon as he can.
The phone rang, the connection having been made, and Sir Thomas spoke to the man on the other end, saying he had an important delivery for the Murmansk route they had spoken of before. There was a pause.
Can you make it any sooner?
He asked.
The opportunity could be lost by then.
Oh, very well.
And you will make the arrangements?
13th of July it is.
Dmitri's spirits fell. That was 3 weeks away.
On the other hand, it gave him time to get the details in place. He had a lot to arrange. When he left the consulate, he went to the town's telegraph office and sent a cable to his mother.
Apologies, but urgent business keeps me away. Stop. Can you wire 2,000 rubles to help conclude deal? Stop. Hope all well. Stop. Will visit soon. Stop. Your son.
Next, he sent a cable to Malevich. Cargo will be ready in Yekaterinburg on 13th of July. Stop. Come a week before with 20 yelka. Stop. Spruce trees, yelka, were the largest and hardiest in the forests where they had fought during the war, and they had sometimes likened the toughest soldiers to them. He was sure Malevich would get the reference. His stomach churning with nerves, he rode back to the cottage to think through every last detail. At last he was taking action. It felt as though he had delayed too long already, and this would be his last chance.
Chapter 29 Lake Akanabi, New York State, September 2016. As September began, the weather at the lake was hot and sunny, but with a fresh breeze. Kitty acquired a deep tan, while her brown hair was streaked with blonde. She turned her attention to reconstructing the jetty, buying fresh planks of wood and tearing up the original in order to rebuild from scratch. She had always loved carpentry. The feel of the wood surrendering cleanly to her saw, the pleasure of joints that fitted snugly, the smoothness after sanding. Once the jetty was finished, she took a canvas chair out there in the early evenings with a bottle of wine and sat reading the books Vera Quigley had lent her, staying until the light was low and the daytime bird calls were giving way to night prowlers. Kitty was soon absorbed in the story of the Romanovs' life in the early years of the 20th century, when they were the wealthiest family on the planet. She read of Alexei's haemophilia and his mother's growing dependence on Rasputin, the Siberian healer and mystic, then the suspicion that grew around them during the First World War, and the anger at their lavish lifestyles while there was famine across the country, leading to the 1917 revolution. The book told of the family's fate in captivity, first at their home in the Alexander Palace in St. Petersburg, then at the governor's house in Tobolsk, Siberia, and finally at the Ipatiev house in Yekaterinburg, to the east of the Ural Mountains. There was a map on which Kitty could see the mountains running north to south down the centre of Russia like a knobbly spine. She read that conditions gradually worsened for the family as Lenin and Trotsky took control of the western part of the country. Their rations were reduced, many of their personal possessions stolen, and the guards treated them with increasing disrespect, forcing them to ring a bell when they wanted to use the lavatory, and limiting their time outside in the yard. It was a far cry from the extravagant luxury they had been used to. Vera Quigley had promised to send a first batch of her translation within a week, so Kitty went to the vacation park coffee house to check her emails. She dismissed the ones from Tom. Kitty, please, I love you. We must talk. Are you ever coming back? Soon she would be ready to reply to him, just not quite yet. To concerned friends, she sent a quick message saying that she was away for the summer in a place with no Wi-Fi, but would be in touch on her return. As she had hoped, there was an email from Vera with a file attached, and she downloaded and opened it. It seemed Vera had translated almost half the diary already, and she wrote that she was so absorbed in the task, she kept forgetting to stop and eat. She was now convinced it was a genuine diary written by Grand Duchess Tatiana. Although the Romanovs had always spoken English in private, the Bolshevik guards insisted they spoke only Russian, and she guessed that's why their diaries were in Russian too. She wrote that she felt immensely privileged Kitty had chosen her to translate it. The diary began in February 1918 and ran through to July that same year. Kitty glanced at the earliest entries, in which Tatiana wrote about a play called The Bear she and her siblings had been rehearsing, and which they performed for their parents on the evening of the 23rd of February. She sounded like a teenager in places. "I couldn't stop giggling when Olga began reciting Maria's lines rather than her own. It ruined the dramatic atmosphere somewhat." Kitty googled and learned that Tatiana had turned 21 while in captivity, so she wasn't a child. Next she looked up Tatiana on Google Images and was startled to find that there were hundreds of pictures of her, wearing a sailor suit on the royal yacht Standart, in formal court dress in 1913, in her nurse's uniform in 1915. The Romanovs obviously loved photography, because there were pictures of them in all kinds of locations. And there were also some rather blurred home movies available online. Kitty watched one that showed the five children parading round a garden in order of height, like the Von Trapps in The Sound of Music. The girls wearing white dresses and wide-brimmed straw hats tied with ribbons. Tatiana rarely smiled, Kitty noticed. She seemed more reserved than the others, more regal somehow, and she was easily the most beautiful, with her heart-shaped face, her penetrating gaze, and soft cascades of brown hair. It seemed incredible that the diary found at the bottom of her suitcase of family photographs had belonged to this woman. It made Kitty feel there was a connection between them. "Who are you?" she wondered, gazing at the black-and-white image of a woman who had died 100 years earlier. Back at the cabin, she read Vera's translation on her laptop. Some entries referred to people she didn't know. "March 22nd, Friday. I wrote to Aunt Ella in Perm. We have such happy memories of the party she took us to. But looking back, we were raw and uncouth, like country cousins. We huddled together not knowing how to talk to anyone, and the other guests avoided us, unsure how to introduce themselves. I pray Ella is safe and sound, and Grandmama and everyone else. I miss them all terribly. We have been captives for over a year now, our fate in God's hands. I remain hopeful, although it seems our future will not be in Russia. I think I can be happy anywhere so long as M is with me." Who was M? Kitty wondered. Her sister Maria? And which side of the family was Aunt Ella from? The entry finished. "At 8 o'clock in the morning, we went to Obednitsa, and after dinner had Vechevnaya, then confessions in the hall. I read more of Anna Karenina before bedtime, and keep wanting to give her a good shake. Vronsky was not worthy of her." Kitty laughed. She had often felt the same way about the gullible heroine of Tolstoy's classic. As she read on, she got a sense of someone with a girlishness about her, yet at the same time, a sense of responsibility for those around her. And although she didn't say as much, Kitty could tell she was anxious. A week later, another batch arrived from Vera, covering the months of April and May 1918. 8th of April, Sunday. Papa is upset because a new directive from the Red Guards forbids him and Alexei from wearing their epaulettes. It is ridiculous, because no one can see us now that we are banned from leaving the grounds. I tried to commiserate, but Papa never discusses our predicament. Perhaps he talks to Mama, but certainly not to me. Olga is sunk into depression, and Maria and Anastasia seem not to comprehend our situation as they fight and play, and fight again, regardless of whether the guards are watching. Mama and Alexei are obsessed by their symptoms, and I can understand that with no distractions it is easy to think of nothing else. But I wish they would try. Forgive me my tetchiness this evening, dear diary. I hope it will evaporate overnight, and I will wake in the morning with a soul of pure compassion. In the early days of May, Tatiana described the tortuous journey they were forced to make from Tobolsk to Yekaterinburg. It seemed to have taken a week, which surprised Kitty, because according to Vera's book, the distance was only about 300 miles. Each jolt of the carriage makes Alexei gasp with pain. I know the driver can hear, and is doing his best to avoid the biggest holes. But the road is in poor condition at this time of year, straight after the thaw. I hope it was easier for Mama, Papa, and Maria, when the ground was still hard with ice. If only we had been able to travel with them. She wrote of their joy in joining their family in Yekaterinburg, and described the accommodation. O-T-M-A. A note from Vera explained that this was the acronym the girls used to refer to all four of them. Shares a room with floral wallpaper and an oriental-style rug. We do not have beds yet, but are sleeping on the floor on our piled-up coats. In the afternoon, we sat for half an hour in the garden, where there are beautiful lilac and honeysuckle bushes. It was a shame to come indoors where the air is stuffy and the heat intense. Some nuns sent eggs and cream to build up Alexei's strength, and it is encouraging to know there are good people in this town who are thinking of us. On the 19th of May, there was a strange entry about an eye in the fence. Vera wrote that she had translated it literally, but wondered if it might perhaps be an obscure metaphor, possibly religious, with which she was not familiar. I don't know what made me notice it, because we were several feet away, but there was a flicker that drew my attention. At first, I thought I must be imagining it. Then I supposed it must be a child, because it is at the level of my chest. But there was something about the way it seemed to follow me that was familiar. And then I made the joyful discovery. The entry finished right there, and Kitty found herself as mystified as Vera had been. What was the discovery? It was frustrating reading a 98-year-old diary. At one moment, she would begin to feel she was getting to know Tatiana, and then some oblique reference made her realize that she knew next to nothing. 14th of June, Thursday. Papa has run out of tobacco and is irascible as a result. I went to speak with Anton, one of the guards, to ask if some might be found, and he made the most obscene request I have ever heard. If M were to hear of it, he would kill him on the spot. The mysterious M again, and he seemed to be a man. She had no idea of his identity, and supposed Tatiana disguised his name in case the guards demanded to read her diary. Kitty knew from one of Vera's books that the girls had sewn their jewels into the seams and linings of their clothes to protect them from the guards' pilfering, but there was no mention of this in her diary. She imagined it would have been uncomfortable to sit down while wearing a garment with jewels in it, seems. They must have been scared witless during those months of waiting to learn their fate, but within the diary there was a focus on the daily routine of meals, prayers, exercise, and reading. It was a quiet life. When the final batch of translation came through, Kitty skipped ghoulishly to the last entry. It was dated Sunday 14th of July, and the tone was somber. Father Storoziev came to conduct a service today with his deacon, Boimerov. We were pleased to see him, because it had been a long time since we took communion. He sang, At Rest with the Saints. Vera inserted a note that this was the Russian Orthodox prayer for the departed. And feeling the relevance of the words, Give rest, O Christ, to the souls of your servants, where there is no sickness, nor sorrow, nor sighing, but life everlasting. We all fell to our knees, apart from Alexei, of course, who cannot get out of his chair. None of us joined in the responses to the liturgy, but at the end we came forward to kiss the cross, and Mama and Papa took the sacrament. As Storoziev left, I whispered thank you to him. I can't say why, but I have a feeling we will not see him again. After that, Tatiana had copied out some words that Vera said were those of a Russian holy man, Eowyn of Kronstadt. Your grief is indescribable. The Saviour's grief in the gardens of Gethsemane for the world's sins is immeasurable. Join your grief to his. In it, you will find consolation. According to the history books, none of them had any idea they had just 2 days to live. But something about the tone of this entry made Kitty wonder if Tatiana perhaps had an inkling.
Chapter 30. Yekaterinburg, Russia, the 26th of June, 1918. Dmitri worked non-stop over the next 3 weeks while setting his plans in motion. He booked rooms to accommodate the 20 men he hoped Malevich would bring with him. Housing them all in one place would have raised suspicion, so he chose lodgings spread around town and reserved 2 or 3 rooms in each. Henry Armistead would stay with Sir Thomas Preston, as he had on previous occasions. When the 2,000 rubles arrived from Dmitri's mother, he took the cash and went to visit the farmer, Pyotr Tolmachov. They sat at his kitchen table, where a sheepdog nuzzled up to Dmitri's thigh, trying to ingratiate itself, as he placed the bag of money on the table and opened the top. "What I want," he said, "is for your daughter to provide me with a plan of the inside of the house, where the family live and where the guards are stationed. We need to know everything about the security arrangements." The farmer's eyes were transfixed by the glints of banknotes, and he nodded in agreement.
"No problem, my friend."
"And then I want her to switch places with Tatiana, the second eldest Romanov girl, for just one night."
"You want what?"
Dmitri continued calmly. "We need to talk to one of the families so that they understand the plans, and Tatiana has the most practical nature. Besides, your daughter resembles her in height, build, and colouring." The farmer's face reddened.
"If she was discovered, she would be executed."
Dmitri shook his head. "She will not be discovered. The imperial family will be forewarned and will surround her so she looks inconspicuous. She will switch clothes with Tatiana and then switch back again the following morning. It is only one night, and in return I am offering your family the chance of a new life." He gestured towards the bag.
"But they might not want their house clean 2 days running," the farmer protested.
"I have noticed the women always work 2 mornings in a row, and we will alter our plans to suit their schedule. I guarantee your daughter will only spend one night there. You have my word." The farmer leant his elbow on the table, hand over his mouth, as he thought.
"I cannot give you an answer now," he said at last. "I must discuss it with my wife and daughter."
"Be wary, my friend. The more people who know, the more likely the secret is to be revealed. And if we cannot carry out the plan, I will not be able to give you the money." He closed the top of the bag and stood. "I will return the day after tomorrow, when I am sure you will have further questions for me." As he rode back to his cottage, Dmitri was stricken with guilt. He knew what he planned was wrong. He knew he would be damned forever if it didn't work out. But he could not risk Tatiana being inside the house when Malevich's men stormed it. He would spring her free before the raid. With any luck, all would be released unharmed. The Romanovs would be spirited safely out of Russia. The farm girl Yelena would return home unsuspected, and Tolmachov could take his cash and relocate to Crimea. But he was taking the precaution of getting Tatiana out of the way in case the guards opened fire during the rescue. May God forgive him. When Dmitri returned to the farm 2 days later, Tolmachov's wife and daughter joined them at the kitchen table.
"I will tell you what I know about the house," Yelena agreed. "But I do not see how I could pass for Grand Duchess Tatiana. I'm nothing like her."
It was true she was a rather plain, pudgy-faced girl, but her height and hair colour were right. "You would be surprised to learn how little we look at another's face once we know them," Dmitri told her. "We form an impression, and after that we glance into a room, see the right number of figures, and think no more of it. So long as you do not engage directly in conversation with the guards, they will believe you are Tatiana, because it will not occur to them to think otherwise."
"But the other cleaners will notice. They all know me."
"Can you trust them?" Dmitri asked. "Or could Tatiana walk out separately at the end of the morning?"
"Perhaps my friend Svetlana will help," she said thoughtfully. "We've both become fond of the Romanov girls."
"You will be the death of my daughter,"
the wife hissed. She was a stocky woman, and Dmitri could tell Yelena would look exactly like her in another 20 years.
I want you to know I am against this.
Hush, the farmer told her. This man is vouched for by the British consulate. I trust him.
Dmitri felt shamed by his trust and moved on quickly.
Perhaps we could talk about the house.
Yelena explained that the family all lived on the first floor, and she drew a plan of the rooms. She showed him where the guards took their meals, where the chapel was, and she drew a map of each of the entrances.
There's a door leading down to the basement just here, she pointed. Some of the guards sleep there.
Dmitri looked at her sketch and asked questions until he felt he could picture every corridor and doorway.
How far in advance do you know the days you will clean? He asked.
Only a couple of days, she said. It is roughly once a week, although the actual dates vary. The next days will be Monday the 8th and Tuesday the 9th of July.
Dmitri nodded.
So after that it could be the 15th and 16th?
I don't know yet.
We'll speak again. Thank you with all my heart for this information.
Malevich and his spruce trees arrived on the 10th of July, and they met at Dmitri's cottage. After they greeted each other, and Dmitri handed round shots of illegal vodka he'd purchased from his landlord, they sat down to study the layout of the Ipatiev house and hear from him about the number of men in the guard posts and the hours at which the guard was changed. There were fewer guards on duty from 1 till 5 in the morning, so they agreed the raid must be between those hours. The plan was to kill the external guards instantly before they could signal to waken their comrades indoors. It was made trickier because a curfew had been imposed on the town, and all citizens were supposed to stay indoors after 8 in the evening. But as yet, it was not being strictly enforced.
"We shoot for the heads," Malevich suggested. "You say the sentry posts are around 20 feet tall, and we will be on the opposite side of the main road. That's close enough range."
Everyone knew it was risky. There were many ways the plan could fail, but they talked it over endlessly, exploring every possibility, until it seemed as foolproof as such things ever can be. Dmitri trusted Malevich with his life, and the men he'd brought were former Imperial Guards, trained to a far more exacting level than any common soldier. He felt a thrill at the impending action. At last, he would be doing something after 17 fruitless months of watching from the sidelines. At last, Tatiana would be free. No one except Tolmachov, his wife and daughter, knew about the plan to free Tatiana from the house. Dmitri was too ashamed to share it with Malevich or Sir Thomas. It had no strategic advantage. It was purely his own selfish scheme to keep her out of harm's way. Dmitri visited the British consulate every few days, and Sir Thomas confirmed that Henry Armistead was still planning to arrive on the 13th. And that he had agreed to help. As the day grew closer, Yelena confirmed that she would be working on the 15th and 16th, and Dmitri asked Sir Thomas to tell Armistead the cargo would be ready for dispatch in the early hours of the 16th. He then wrote a note for Tatiana to warn her of what would happen.
"We need your help to plan a rescue. On Monday, a cleaner will switch clothes with you while they are working in the house, and you should leave with the other cleaners and let her take your place. Don't be scared. I will be waiting outside."
It was only as he wrote this that it dawned on him what a huge risk he was asking her to take. What would happen if she were discovered trying to walk out? What if a guard intercepted this note? But still, he convinced himself, it was safer than being inside the Ipatiev house during the rescue operation. He walked past the house on Friday the 12th while the girls were in the yard, and looked through the knothole. Once he was sure Tatiana had spotted him, he stuck the note into the hole so it protruded only slightly on the other side, then walked off. He turned back as he reached the street corner and could see the paper had already gone. There was no changing his mind now. Chapter 31. Yekaterinburg, Russia, the 13th to the 15th of July, 1918. On Saturday the 13th of July, Dmitri rode to the consulate in the afternoon, hoping to meet Henry Armistead, only to be told he still had not arrived.
"Don't worry," Sir Thomas assured him. "I telephoned and was told that he left yesterday, so he should be here by nightfall. Come again tomorrow."
The following day there was still no sign of him, and no word either. Armistead must have been delayed on the journey. Dmitri felt he would explode with tension. He ran his fingers through his hair, and hardly noticed when he yanked out a strand. Pain was a welcome distraction. He met Malevich early on Sunday evening to discuss the options.
"I think we should go ahead. The arrangements are made. All the men are here," Dmitri argued. "The longer we wait, the more chance there is of something happening to them."
Malevich was adamantly against it.
"There is no point freeing the Romanovs without a strategy to whisk them out of the country. They can't get on a train without the railway workers reporting it. It's too far to reach safety by road. We need Armistead's help."
Dmitri had to accept he was right, but felt panicky at the thought of waiting. Anything could happen in a week. After their meeting, Dmitri tried calling on Sir Thomas again, but there was no sign of the merchant, and Sir Thomas was at a loss to explain his absence. He tried to calm the increasingly distraught Dmitri.
"He has never let me down before. I'm sure he'll be here tomorrow."
Dmitri didn't explain to him why he was quite so agitated. Sir Thomas didn't know that the following day Yelena would be going into the Ipatiev house to change places with Tatiana. Should Dmitri stop her, or should he trust that Mr. Armistead would appear and the plan could proceed? Back at his cottage, Dmitri sat up late mulling over the options until his brain was frazzled, absent-mindedly stroking the waistcoat Tatiana had knitted for him. There was still time to ride to Tolmachov's farm and tell Yelena that the plan was delayed till the following week. But he was reluctant, because he yearned so badly to see Tatiana. He had been counting the hours until he could hold her in his arms, and a week seemed an impossibly long delay. Eventually, he decided that Yelena should go ahead and make the switch. If Armistead did not arrive, it could be a trial run for the following week, giving Dmitri a chance to brief Tatiana about their plans, so the family could take cover when the rescue began. He convinced himself it made sense. Next morning, Dmitri watched as the party of cleaning ladies made their way into the Ipatiev house at 8 a.m, Yelena among them. He rode around the town, in an attempt to contain his extreme agitation. This was the moment when it could all go wrong. At 11, he inquired at the consulate, to be told that Mr. Armistead had still not appeared, and he glanced into the exercise yard to see Tatiana strolling with her sisters. Was she going to do as asked? She must be petrified. At 12 noon, he positioned himself on a street corner just a few houses further down Voznesensky Prospect, and consulted his pocket watch, wearing an old jacket and cap like a factory worker. The gates opened, and a group of women walked out in a huddle. Dmitri strained his eyes to pick out individual figures, but he couldn't see either Tatiana or Yelena. His heart was thudding against his ribcage. The women wandered down the road. Then the gate opened again, and two more emerged, arm in arm. Straight away, Dmitri recognized her. How could the guards not see? She walked differently from the other women. Even when wearing the plain bonnet and gown of a farmer's daughter, she was transparently a grand duchess. He felt as if he might faint, such was the mixture of excitement and terror that swirled in his blood. Neither of the guards at the gate gave her a second glance, and she walked down the road with her arm through that of another cleaner, presumably Yelena's friend Svetlana. Only when she looked up and saw him could he tell she was terrified. It was an extraordinarily courageous thing to do, but Dmitri had never doubted she would manage. As she drew near, he took her arm and thanked Svetlana, who whispered,
"Good luck. See you tomorrow."
Tatiana's whole body was trembling as Dmitri led her round a corner and down the street to where his horse was tethered.
"I'm afraid I don't have a side saddle," he apologized, his voice hoarse with emotion.
"That's all right,"
she said quietly, and mounted, adjusting her skirts. Dmitri mounted behind her, glanced back at the house. Then they rode off without any further words.
Tatiana was free.
Dmitri's heart sang as he sat with his arms looped around her to hold the reins. She was here, with him, no longer a prisoner. He could feel the warmth of her flesh, and her hair blowing in the wind stroked his face. Behind them the road was clear, apart from some peasants on horseback. There were none of the cars or trucks driven by Red Guardsmen. They'd got away with it.
Inside the cottage, she was still trembling when at last he enclosed her in his arms and held her tight. He unfastened her bonnet and caressed her as she clung to him.
"Oh, Dmitri,"
she cried,
"why have you done this? What will happen to the family if my absence is discovered?"
Dmitri explained that he was waiting for a merchant to arrive that day, and they hoped to spring her family from captivity that very night. If not, she would return to the house the following morning, and the plan would be carried out at a later date. She listened carefully, her eyes widening.
"But how will you rescue them? Who will carry Alexei? Where will we go?"
He told her that these details had been worked out by his men, who were loyal retainers from the St. Petersburg Imperial Guard.
"And am I to stay here tonight? With you?"
She looked around.
"Yes. I must go out this afternoon to meet the merchant, and if the rescue is proceeding tonight, I will join the men, but I will return to you immediately with news. You will be safe here. It is very isolated."
She needed time to take it in, and sank down on a chair, laying her hands flat on the table to stop them shaking.
"It is as well you are doing this now.
I did not like to warn you in a note, but we all sense the end is near. The lack of respect with which the new guards treat us, the impertinence. We are an unwanted problem for the Red Guards. They resent the food we eat, the men it takes to hold us captive."
"You think they plan to move you again?"
She shook her head. "Perhaps. I don't know."
"You are safe, Tatiana." He knelt at her feet and leaned his elbows on her lap.
"Trust me. I won't let anything happen to you now, or to your family."
She stroked his hair.
"My husband,"
she said, her voice husky with love.
"I am so blessed."
He had a little food in the kitchen, but she said she was too anxious to take more than a cup of tea. They moved to the sofa and cradled each other, talking about all that had happened during the months of separation, about the lowest moments of despair, about her exhilaration mixed with fear when she read his note and realized he had a plan to free them.
"There have been other plans, too," he told her, and explained about Yakovlev's scheme to get them to Omsk and Henry Armistead's plan to get them to Murmansk. "The British consul is helping," he said, and that seemed to reassure her a little.
They exchanged long, passionate kisses that afternoon. There was a bedroom just through a doorway, but Dmitri did not dream of trying to make love to her. There would be plenty of time for that in their new life. For now, it was sheer luxury to hear her voice, taste her lips, feel the softness of her cheek against his, and wrap her in his arms, safe at last. They leaned their foreheads together, and this time both were able to read each other's thoughts because they were thinking exactly the same thing. Time seemed to stretch, like a dream, but then Dmitri consulted his pocket watch and realized it was almost 5.
"I must go to the consulate now to see if Armistead has arrived. Whatever happens, I will be back within the hour," he promised. "Bolt the door behind me, and don't open it again until you hear my voice."
"Please be quick,"
she pleaded, and he agreed, hand over heart.
"Rest now, my precious,"
he told her with one last lingering kiss. "We may not get much sleep tonight." When he arrived at the consulate, Dmitri was met by a very apologetic Sir Thomas. Malevich was already there, looking downcast.
"I've just heard from Armistead," Sir Thomas told him. "He did his best to get through to Yekaterinburg, but there are soldiers blocking all the access roads. You have no doubt heard about the advance of the Czech legions through Siberia. Latest news is that they are less than 100 miles away."
Dmitri was appalled.
"Armistead can't let us down, not now. When will he come? Don't you see? He may not need to come if the Czechs free Yekaterinburg. They are defeating the Bolsheviks wherever they go, and have formed a provisional government in Omsk. At long last, an effective white army is fighting back against the Reds."
This did nothing to lessen Dmitri's panic.
"But the Bolsheviks will move the Romanovs before they get here. They will never let the white army claim such a prize."
Sir Thomas had to agree this was likely, but had a suggestion. "When they are a little closer, your men can make contact and arrange to hand over the family to their safekeeping. I can see it will be fraught, but it's the only way to proceed." Dmitri paced up and down. "Can't we go ahead with the rescue tonight? The Red Guard will become desperate as the Whites draw near. Anything could happen."
Malevich intervened. "But where would the family go? There's nowhere to keep them safe in this town, and there are roadblocks all around. Wait a week, two at most. If there is any attempt to move them, we can intervene. It might prove easier to spring them loose while on the road than inside a heavily guarded house."
Dmitri bit his lip. He wanted the rescue to proceed that night, but only because he couldn't bear to let Tatiana return to the house now he had her safe. "Their lives are at risk. I can't just sit and wait."
Malevich patted him on the shoulder. "We will keep watch and move if we have to.
Do not fear, Malama. Stay strong."
Dmitri was close to tears as he rode back to the cottage in the dusk. He knew there was nothing he could say that would persuade Tatiana to abandon her family. She would have to be taken first thing the following morning to enter the house with the other cleaners. He couldn't bear the thought of saying goodbye to her again, not knowing when he would next hold her in his arms. Oh, if only she would choose to stay. As he rode into the lane that led to the cottage, he could see from afar that the front door was open. What was Tatiana doing? He had told her not to open it to anyone. As he got nearer, he saw it had been smashed and hung from its frame in splintered pieces. Fear gripping his heart, Dmitri leapt from his horse and rushed inside.
"Tatiana!"
He screamed her name and ran from room to room in blind panic. A chair lay overturned in the sitting room, but she wasn't there. He checked again, looking inside cupboards, behind drapes. The bag stuffed with money was still beneath the bed, so that ruled out robbery. Next, he searched the outhouse and the nearby woods, with a pressure in his chest so painful that he staggered.
"Tatiana!"
He screamed at the top of his voice and began the search all over again in case he had missed anything.
Where was she? How could she simply disappear?
Towards one copse there were hoofprints in the soil and possible signs of a scuffle. He leapt on his horse and set off in that direction, but when he came to a fork in the road, he could see no tracks to indicate which way the riders might have gone. He was howling with grief, like a man possessed, as he picked one path and rode down it into the gathering night. Chapter 32. Yekaterinburg, Russia, the 15th to the 16th of July, 1918. When Dmitri could control himself enough to think clearly, he realized one or more men on horseback must have followed them to his cottage. He had been looking out for Red Guards in a car or truck, their normal mode of transport, and had been so ecstatic to hold Tatiana in his arms once more that his professional caution had slipped at the most crucial moment. The pursuers must have waited till he left the cottage, then snatched her. Did that mean she was back at the Ipatiev house already? He would not be able to tell until 11 the following morning, when they came out to exercise in the yard. What had made the guards suspicious? Maybe one of the other cleaning ladies told them of the impostor in their midst. Perhaps Yelena had panicked and told them herself. What would happen to her now? Might she be back at the farm, having secured her freedom with a betrayal? He decided not to disturb the farmer and his wife with the news, but rode to the Ipatiev house, keeping out of sight on side roads and alleyways. It was after 8, so the curfew was in operation, and the only signs of life were the night guards standing in their turrets. Next he went to the lodgings where Malevich was staying, got the landlady to fetch him, and explained in a shaking voice what he had done.
"We must storm the house straight away," he insisted.
He could tell Malevich was horrified at his actions, although he hid his emotions beneath a professional soldier's veneer.
"If she is back inside the house, you can be sure they will have doubled the guard in preparation for an attack tonight. And the fact remains that there is nowhere to take the family. Let us sleep on the problem and consult Sir Thomas tomorrow. Perhaps he can make inquiries through official channels."
"You don't understand, Malevich."
Dmitri was almost in tears.
"They might kill her tonight."
"I think I'm beginning to understand," he said gently, putting an arm round his friend's shoulder. "You should have told me before. I did not realize you were in love with her."
"More than love. Much more than love,"
Dmitri whispered, his eyes swimming.
"Come then. I will ride out with you around the town and its outskirts. I'll bring rifles."
They trotted up and down the back streets one by one, stopping to watch and listen whenever they passed official buildings, ducking out of sight when they saw soldiers. It remained light until almost midnight, but when the darkness fell, it was hopeless to search further.
What if it wasn't Red Guards who took her? Who else knew of your plan?
Malevich asked.
Only the farmer, Tolmachov, and his wife and daughter, and the daughter's friend, Svetlana.
Dmitri's mind kept running through the possibilities. Could Tolmachov's wife have turned them in to protect her daughter? But then they wouldn't get the money, and her daughter might be imprisoned anyway, so that didn't make sense. He couldn't believe Svetlana had betrayed them, after the way she carefully guided Tatiana out of the house. But perhaps she had.
"Let's go to your cottage and try to retrace their steps," Malevich suggested, and Dmitri was grateful for a plan. His own brain was overwhelmed.
As they approached, he prayed for a miracle, that they would go in and find Tatiana sitting on the sofa with a plausible explanation for her absence. He held his breath as they dismounted and ran indoors, but there was just echoing silence, the absence of the woman who filled all his waking thoughts, who had been there in the flesh just a few hours before.
"Isn't it strange," Malevich mused, "that if it was the Red Guards who took her, they didn't arrest you both?
Perhaps there were only a few, and they feared I might overpower them.
But in that case, you'd think they would return with reinforcements."
He sat down.
"Perhaps it was not the Red Guards after all. Perhaps word reached the White Army and they sent an advance party to fetch her."
Dmitri felt a ray of hope.
"Do you think that's possible? But how could they have heard she was here?"
"I don't know. Maybe the farmer told someone. I will ride out and make contact with them tomorrow. They are led by Admiral Kolchak. Do you remember him from the war?"
Dmitri shook his head.
"He's a good man. I will ask if they have the Grand Duchess and liaise with them over the rescue and handover of the remaining Romanovs. You stay here, keep an eye on the Ipatiev house, and see if Sir Thomas can exert pressure on the Red Guards.
But now, I think, we should try to get some sleep, Malama.
I will take the sofa."
It took much persuasion, but at last Dmitri went into the bedroom and threw himself fully dressed on the bed. As he lay there, eyes wide open, he noticed something sticking out from beneath a cupboard, as if kicked there. He got up to retrieve it, and found it was a notebook filled with Tatiana's impeccable handwriting. It was her diary. She must have brought it with her, concealed in her clothing. Did she want to keep it safe from the guards? Was she planning to give it to him? She had written the last entry on Sunday, just over 24 hours earlier. He couldn't bear to read her words, but he held the book to his face, sniffing its pages. His fear for her was so acute, it was like a hole gouged through his insides. Malevich rode off at first light to locate the White Army headquarters, which he had heard were in Kamensk, some 100 miles distant. Like Dmitri, he was a skilled horseman and should make it in a day, whereupon he promised to send a telegram to the consulate with news. Dmitri went out to examine the hoof prints he had spotted the previous evening. It looked as though there had only been 2, or at most 3 men, but still he couldn't find any trail beyond the crossroads. At 8, he rode into town and watched from a distance as the cleaning ladies entered the Ipatiev house, their number 1 fewer than yesterday. Next he went to call upon Sir Thomas and made his shameful confession, that he had rescued Tatiana, then lost her again. Sir Thomas looked stern.
"So you think the farm girl is still in the house?"
"I will be able to tell when they come outside to exercise at 11.
"What will she do? My goodness, this is a muddle. I will send an immediate request for a guarantee of the Romanov safety, and will make inquiries amongst my local contacts. If the farm girl does not emerge with the other cleaners, you must go and tell her parents. That will not be a pleasant task, I'm afraid. And then we will wait for news."
Dmitri remained in the consulate all morning, watching the house from an upstairs window. He refused all offers of food and drink. Even a sip of tea made him feel as though he was choking. He could see no signs of life at the blanked-out windows, but at 11 o'clock, 5 figures appeared in the yard, and he sprinted down the stairs and up the road. He rushed round the side of the Ipatiev house, and bent to peer through the knothole, every nerve on edge. He could tell the tall, slim figure in Tatiana's gown was the farm girl long before she turned her head. The family all looked tense and scared, wandering around the yard without talking, and Nicholas paced up and down as usual. Only the dogs displayed their normal exuberance. Dmitri wished he could get a message to Yelena, telling her that she would be rescued soon. If only he had spoken to Svetlana that morning. If only he hadn't done such a despicable thing in the first place. He was waiting on the corner when the cleaning ladies left the house at 12, and Svetlana rushed straight over, her face white with worry.
"Where is Tatiana? Yelena doesn't know what to do. How can she leave if they do not change places again?"
"I know. I'm sorry. We're doing what we can. Say nothing to anyone, and your friend will be freed soon." His promise sounded hollow even to his own ears, and he could tell Svetlana was not reassured. After that, he rode out to Tolmachov's farm and told the farmer and his wife what had happened.
"Svolach!"
The wife slapped him hard across the face.
"You promised us she would be safe."
She began to wail.
"I will never forgive you."
Dmitri quickly explained their plan to free the Romanovs and shepherd them into the hands of the White Army.
"It will be any day now," he promised. "I will keep you informed. The good thing is that none of the guards suspect the substitution has been made, and the family are keeping up the pretense. Yelena is perfectly safe for now."
"She must be so scared,"
the farmer breathed.
"You guarantee it will be over soon?"
"I give you my word," he told them. One way or another, it would. Before he left, he placed the bag containing 2,000 rubles on their kitchen floor. The farmer's wife kicked it.
"What use is your money without our daughter? Did you think of that? Or was she not a person to you, just a body you could buy? You disgust me."
Dmitri hung his head in misery. He disgusted himself too. Dmitri went back to the consulate that afternoon, and Sir Thomas let him sit by the window to keep an eye on the Ipatiev house. At least he felt as though he was doing something, however futile. The family came out to exercise at 3, but Yelena wasn't with them, which sent Dmitri into a fresh spiral of panic. Where was she? Had her identity been revealed? He noticed cars coming and going, but wasn't sure if there were more than normal, and could not make out any of the occupants. His blood was pounding, and he paced up and down, unable to keep still. "Go home before the curfew," Sir Thomas told him at 7. "Your being here serves no purpose. We will have more information in the morning." Reluctantly, Dmitri rode back to the cottage, once again hoping that through some miracle, Tatiana might have found her way back there. But she hadn't. He cried as he touched the space on the sofa where she had sat, and listened to the silence all around. After 2 nights of very little sleep, he managed to doze for a few hours, but woke with fear gripping his heart. What had he done? Had he ruined everything with his thoughtlessness? If so, he could never live with himself. He rode to the consulate as soon as the curfew was lifted in the morning, and was met by Sir Thomas, who looked grey and worried. "Sit down, Malama," he instructed. "I have some news which I think is credible." Dmitri felt his legs give way. He collapsed into a chair.
"Bad news." "I'm afraid so. It's being said that Tsar Nicholas was shot and killed by the Red Guards last night."
Chapter 33. Yekaterinburg, Russia, the 17th of July, 1918. Dmitri couldn't breathe. His Tsar, his commander-in-chief, had been executed. His first thought was that it must be his fault for smuggling Tatiana out of the house. How would he ever live with himself? Tatiana was sure to hold him responsible. "What of the others?" he croaked.
"Word is that the rest of the family have been moved elsewhere for safekeeping."
Sir Thomas looked grave.
"Moved where?"
"I was told by one source that they have gone to Verkhoturye, but there's no confirmation. I stress I don't know any of this for sure, but local people heard a disturbance around 3 in the morning, and there are reports of a number of vehicles leaving the house."
Dmitri leapt up. "I will ride to Verkhoturye today. I must do something. It's almost 200 miles north. I will telephone when I arrive." "Ah, yes. And your friend Malevich sent a telegram this morning. He has met Kolchak, the White Army commander, but says none of their men know anything of Tatiana's whereabouts." This was a blow. It meant Tatiana was almost certainly being held by the Red Guards. He must get to Verkhoturye as soon as humanly possible. Dmitri knew Tatiana would take it very hard to lose her father. If only he could hold her in his arms and comfort her. He'd barely had time to mourn his own father, but if he could just find her, he would try to help her recover from this shocking loss. Dmitri rode day and night without rest, arriving in Verkhoturye at noon on the 18th of July. It was a tiny town on the Tura River, with historic buildings and a pretty cathedral. There were no more than 100 private dwellings set along one main road and half a dozen cross streets. He should be able to find the family quite easily in such a place. But after riding up and down each street, he could see no house with guards posted outside. Wherever they were, there were bound to be guards. He knocked on the door of a female monastery and asked the elderly nun who answered if there had been any new arrivals in town over the past day, but she replied,
"Only yourself, sir."
He spent the afternoon touring the countryside around the town, wondering if they might be in a remote building somewhere, his thoughts in turmoil. Could it really be true that Nicholas was murdered without a trial, with no chance to defend himself? What kind of people were these new rulers? As evening fell, he took a room in the area's only hotel and asked if he might use their telephone, but when he spoke to Sir Thomas, the only further news was that the family appeared to have been transported from the Ipatiev house in trucks rather than carriages, yet another sign of the lack of respect now shown towards them. Sir Thomas's informant was a local woman who had seen the trucks pull out between 3 and 4 in the morning. Perhaps they were slow-moving, and the party had not yet arrived in Verkhoturye. Dmitri couldn't remember seeing any trucks on the road, but maybe he had overtaken them when they stopped for the night. "I will continue my search tomorrow," Dmitri said. It was the only thing he could think of. He had to keep himself occupied, or he would go completely insane. A week later, an inconsolable Dmitri returned to Yekaterinburg, having scoured every part of the countryside between there and Verkhoturye without finding a trace of the Romanovs. He discovered there had been dramatic changes in town since he left. The White Army had arrived, chasing out the Bolsheviks, and celebration was in the air. Flags hung from buildings, and flowers lay trampled on the streets where townspeople had tossed them at the liberating army. "It is like emerging from a huge cave into the daylight," Sir Thomas told Dmitri. "We need no longer kowtow to those insufferable Red Guards."
"But is there further news of the Imperial family?"
"Nothing as yet. International pressure is mounting on the Bolsheviks to hand them over. King Alfonso of Spain and King Christian of Denmark are making diplomatic representations. I imagine we will learn their whereabouts very soon." Dmitri turned away. Every moment was sheer torture as he speculated what might have become of Tatiana. He prayed she had not been punished for attempting to escape. Surely they wouldn't do that. She was so young, so luminous. "The Ipatiev house is abandoned," Sir Thomas told him. "No one guards the gates, and curious townspeople have been wandering in." Dmitri glanced out the window. "Perhaps there will be a clue to where they have gone. I'll go and take a look." He hurried across the road and joined a group going through the main gate. He knew the layout from the map Yelena had drawn, and headed up to the first floor, then along to the bedroom the four girls had shared. Muted sunlight shone through the whitewash windows, and the air was stale and sour. Their four camp beds remained, the covers rumpled. On the floor lay odd items, a toothbrush, a prayer book, a needle and thread. He picked up the prayer book and saw Maria's name written inside. She must have forgotten it. A middle-aged peasant woman pulled a picture of the Holy Mother from the wall and clutched it like a prize. Dmitri searched through the other items lying around, but did not find anything to indicate where the family might have gone. All that was clear was that they had left in a hurry. It felt strange and wrong to be in the girl's bedroom. Next door was the Tsar and Tsarina's bedroom, with Alexei's bed at the foot of theirs, and the same scattering of personal items. Bibles, images of saints, some porcelain.